just saying how the bullet hit him in the lung and exploded from his back.
It's the day, it's Christmas, and from this day we must parade.
What should we talk about this evening, Mr. Lee?
Well, I was thinking that we could just talk about what we've been up to, what we've been into.
Yeah. What are you drinking? The most important question, what are you drinking?
Well, the honest answer to that is a cup of tea.
Oh, my God. Well, there's nothing wrong with a cup of tea.
I know. I mean, I've only got some poor quality lager in the fridge. I ended up buying some Aldi stuff.
Well, you say that, but I have to say that I do think that Aldi's Galahad lager is excellent.
Well, I've got the French one. Can't remember what it's called now, but
I know, yeah, the Saint-Étienne or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
The Galahad for £3.52 for four, which is their sort of 4%. It's kind of equivalent to a Foster's. But I have to say, it's a lot better than a Foster's.
Foster's is like my usual go-to lager, to be honest.
Is it? I find it's okay. But I sometimes think I'd stick a bit of lime on it because it's a bit bland. Whereas I think that the Galahad has just got a little bit of something about it, a bit of sparkle. It's something.
I'll
very nice.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. But tonight, sir, I have got in front of me, not even opened it yet, I'm just stroking it like a pet. I've got my Madrí Excepcional right
Lovely.
In front of me, right here.
Lovely.
And I've also got my Madrí Excepcional glass that I nicked from a local pub.
Well, did I tell you, Dave, I found a Madrí Excepcional glass outside a Tesco's in Manchester.
Oh, fabulous.
And I did take it home, which
Good
I
lad.
Know is a bit grotty. But
no, it's not at all. It's perfect.
Put it in the dishwasher and it's
exactly.
A beautiful glass.
It is a beautiful glass. It's got the Italian Pearly King on the front, hasn't it? Inside the little red square with Madrí Excepcional written on it. Wonderful. I'm going to open it now, Lee. Just listen to this. Listen to this crack. Oh, listen to that.
Beautiful.
I'm going to pour it in the glass.
I've just been reminded of, do you remember when we were on holiday in Scotland and you bought that lager?
Yeah.
Tesco's own brand lager, but it was the really cheap version.
Cheap.
And I think it was 2%, wasn't it?
2%.
And you were seeing how long it would take you to get pissed. Obviously, you
impossible.
Didn't get pissed. It was impossible, wasn't it? What's
I found
the point of
that,
a 2% lager?
Well, if you remember at the time, it was so cheap, though. It was ridiculous. It was like 4 for 99p or something. It was crazy. I mean, it's obviously booze has gone up a lot. But it was cheap as chips. But I discovered a way to make it, one, more palatable, and two, still very, very cheap, still way below your standard lager, was to buy that stuff, that shit, and mix it with a very cheap sherry. so you'd pour like a measure of the cheap sherry into the cheap lager, and hey presto, you had like a bit more of a lively bodied lager with a little bit of a, you know, very nice bit of a chaser. You know,
you might have invented a drink there, Dave. Like
I think I might have done,
like a lady
it was
boy
good. Yeah, a lady boy. I called that drink a mantis.
Well, one thing I've been getting really into since the start of the year, I made a bit of a vow to read a lot because reading is something I love, but I don't tend to get much time to do it. I mean, I can't seem to do it very well on the commute. And at night, I can only really read for about 20 minutes to half an hour. So it takes me yonks to get through books, but I've been trying audio books taken to them. So I've listened to like quite a few audiobooks, and at the same time I'm reading proper books, and it's been really good. But one of the books I read or listened to was Planet of the Apes, Dave. Have you ever read that?
I love that. Did you get it? I take it you've got it on CD. Oh no, you probably
I subscribed to Audible, the Amazon
Yes, I see. Yeah.
Thing. It was a special offer.
Play through your phone. Play yeah. through your phone with headphones. Yeah, yeah, brilliant.
So it's written by Pierre Boulle.
Pierre Boulle, that's right.
French. Yeah. And it's good. It's quite interesting. It was written in the early 60s, obviously, but parts of it a bit dry, to be honest. And the lead character, I can't remember his name now, but he's a right posh, pompous twat, honestly. He's not really anything like Taylor.
So it's nothing like Charlton Heston?
No.
No.
No. He's really quite irritating, actually, and I'm not surprised that the apes gave him a bit of a hard time. But what was interesting was that the end of it, if you obviously the famous ending in the 68 version, but it's a different ending in the book because
really
what happens is the character and Zero, one of the human savages that he has a baby with, they fly off in the spaceship and return to Earth.
They fix up the spaceship and
So they return to Earth. But the twist is when they get to Earth, because it is set on a different planet, which is obviously different to the film. When they get to Earth, they discovered that it's been taken over by apes.
Ah.
Which is the same, actually, as the Tim Burton ending. If you remember the Tim Burton remake.
Well, I have never seen it. I've never watched it. So I didn't know.
I watched it a few weeks ago. It's not bad. Not brilliant. Charlton Heston's in it as an ape, you know.
Is he?
He has like a bit of a cameo. Roth. Tim Roth is like the bad chimpanzee, General Tade. And his dad is Charlton Heston. But I read something that Tim Roth said, if he knew Heston was going to be in the film, he never would have agreed to do it because he just hates Heston's stance on guns.
Yeah, he's very militant on guns, and he very very right wing he was, Charlton Heston, wasn't he, before he died? And yet he was a big civil rights campaigner in the 60s, very conflicting idea guy. Heston did all these brilliantly provocative films in the 60s, like Planet of the Apes, like Soylent Green, you know, like The Amiga Man, these really interesting projects about where the world could be in the future, you know. And yet he had this really kind of hard-nosed right-wing, certainly on the whole gun control thing, but I'm pretty sure he was a Republican, not a Democrat. Funny, really. And he made, you know, Touch of Evil, and made some great films, didn't he, you know?
Yeah, yeah. He's a big sort of hero as a kid, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Big star, big hero. And again, you know, great films, but he was, you know, again, it's very weird when you find that out about certain celebrities, you know. Even like Eastwood, you know, Eastwood's very right wing, but some of his films are very left leaning in their ideas, I think, you know. And I like him as a filmmaker. He's made some great films, Eastwood, you know. And one that really is a big surprise to me, was a huge surprise to me when I found out, was John Voight. I mean, John Voight is like fucking batshit crazy Donald Trump right wing. I mean, he's real. But look at the films he's done, and look at the roles he's played, you know, like Midnight Cowboy. And
Most people go more right-wing as they get older, don't they?
Coming Home, he's done like Coming Home and all that, all of like anti-Vietnam and everything. Yeah, weird, because I don't know if he was even right-wing back then. You know, when he was making films like Midnight Cowboy, I'd be very surprised if he had the same political views.
Yeah.
James Woods is another one. Jimmy Woods is so, I mean...
Is he?
I was reading the other day, he's super right wing.
Wow.
And you look at the things he's done, it's amazing. He did all those brilliant like television dramas with James Garner as well in the 80s about the people who started Alcoholics Anonymous, and the one about the schizophrenia, the brothers with he was Jim Garner's brother with schizophrenia, you know. Really
never
kind of
them.
Oh, they're brilliant. I remember watching them with my family. They're brilliant. And he was great friends with James Garner. Great friends. And
I always like James Woods.
Oh, you know, I like James Woods. I like James Woods.
Bestseller.
Absolutely. And I have to say as well, I love James Garner too. James Garner was a brilliantly underrated actor, I think.
Mm.
Brilliant actor. To this day, James Woods loves James Garner. He just called him his prince. And he's honestly, just read, if you just go onto his Twitter page, he'll just tell you how much he just saying in this tweet about how much he loves James Garner. But yeah, I know what you mean, like Salvador, Once Upon a Time in America, Boost. There's so many films that James Woods has done, which is so bloody brilliant. But listeners, if you get a chance to see The Promise, for example, or the other one, the other, I can't remember the name of the other one, him and James Garner are the people that started up Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the other one, The Promise, is where James Garner has to look after his brother, James Woods, who's got schizophrenia. And that won everything. That's the most awarded daytime television program in America ever.
Really?
That film.
Right,
yeah.
Check that out.
It's called The Promise.
Well, he sort of seems to have retired, hasn't he, James Garner, James Woods? I mean, I think he just chucked it all in. He couldn't be arsed with it anymore.
Yeah, I think.
You know, Hollywood and all that.
I think that's part of it. I think he just disagrees with a lot of the sort of left leaning of Hollywood and all that. And it's very surprising because you would have really taken him, I would have taken him as quite a left leaning. If you look at his films and the people he's worked with, you kind of would, wouldn't you? I don't know. Shows you. Not everyone is. Not everyone in Hollywood is particularly left leaning.
Oh, I'm just looking here that there's a headline that says how James Woods became a MAGA martyr.
Yeah, MAGA martyr. It's unbelievable. It's crazy. I mean, really extreme right wing. It's mad.
Yeah. So have you been reading anything lately, Dave?
I'm glad you brought that up, Lee, because I have, but only on an audiobooks point of view. I find it so hard at the moment. Every time I pick up a book to read, you know, it's usually late at night by the time I think, and my eyes are going.
Yeah, I know. Really tired.
So hard. It's really hard. I read so much. Terrible, isn't it, now? I'm reading all the time from a tablet or whatever, but it's usually like bite-sized things and one thing or another. But I do a lot of driving about for work, and I've got this hilarious car. I bought this car. You don't even know this, do you? It's hilarious.
No.
Because my old car, which was a Ford Fiesta, quite a modern one, it got written off by this old guy. When in my previous job, this old guy, I don't know how he did it. He reversed into my car and he basically smashed the door in on my car. When it was stationary, parked, I was in work. It's the car park of work, my old job. And he wrote my car off.
Yeah.
So I got some money for my car. I got quite a decent deal on it, really. And in return, I bought this really old car. Okay, this is hilarious. I bought what's called a Hyundai Amica. It's a little runaround. But there's a twist. It's a 20-year-old car, but it had only been driven 27,000 miles.
Wow.
Right. I know. It was like a new car. Honest to God, it was like new. And it's because it was only ever used on the back of it was attached to the back of a holiday camper home, right? People would, what do they call them? Holiday camper van.
Camper van,
I suppose. Yeah. There's another word for it, though, isn't it? You know, quite a big one.
RV.
Like an RV. Let's say an RV for want of.
For our American friends. For our
American friends, yeah. There's another word for it, though, isn't there? What's the
motorhome?
Motor fucking home. Thank you. For fuck's sake. Jesus. Brain cells. So, anyway. And all it was used for was tootling about at the destination. You know? Uh-huh. Park up the motorhome. Take the little amica. Have a little spin around wherever village and little coastal resort. So, as a consequence, it was hardly fucking used. And I got it for like £1,000. It's honestly, it's one of the best buys of my life, Lee.
Yeah.
And wait for it. It's so old. It's got a tape player in it. It's not even a CD player.
Lovely. You've so probably good. Still got tapes.
I have. I've got loads. And do you know what? I actually use some tapes for my work as well. Because it's a bit boring, this, listeners, but I go around and I sing and entertain at care homes, you know, and it's great. I love it.
I've got an idea for you to branch out, Dave.
Oh, have you?
I'll tell you about that later, because there's a related subject I want to talk about
tonight. Oh, I'll be interested to hear. Yeah. But yeah, I've got a lot of clients now, and I go around and it's great. And, you know, today I actually performed in front of three women, amongst others, whose combined age was 287 years. One was 100 years old, one was 97, and one was 90. And they were amazing, singing, mouthing every word of every song, and totally with it, incredibly. Honestly, it's inspiring. It's awe-inspiring.
Mm.
But anyway, going back to the audiobook idea, I have been on eBay looking for nice tape ideas that I can put on my travels, because I don't necessarily want to sing when I'm singing so much. So I don't necessarily want music. I want to listen to stuff. I want to listen to the spoken word. And I found a brilliant tape version of On the Waterfront. Okay?
Yeah.
Read by the actor from Raiders of the Lost Ark, the sort of chubby American guy, one of the two FBI, CIA guys who talk to Indy at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
You picture him, can't you? You know what I mean? Fat fella.
Mustache.
Fat fella with a mustache, yeah. And he's brilliant. He does all the different voices, the characters. And I've been loving listening to it, because that, I love that story. And I don't know, listeners, if you've ever seen the film On the Waterfront. It's an amazing film. Marlon Brando, Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb. Fantastic film.
Steiger.
Rod Steiger, of course. The famous speech. It could have been a contender, Charlie. You know, the whole thing.
But that's not a book, is it, Dave? Was it a book?
It was a book beforehand, yeah, and a famous story. And I'm so glad you were talking about the Planet of the Apes ending, because the ending of On the Waterfront, which anyone who's seen the film, and there's spoilers here, folks, for the book and for the film, knows that Terry, Rod Steiger's brother Terry, the ex-prize fighter who had to take a dive, who's been manipulated by all these union gangsters, union boss gangsters, because that's what they are. They're not union leaders, really. They're just fucking gangsters on the waterfront. Terry's been manipulated by him all his life and now decides to take a stand, especially at the death of his brother, you know. So he faces Johnny Friendly, Lee J. Cobb, and they have a right royal scrap at the end. And Terry, even though he's bleeding and he's in a state, he gets up and he still goes into work on the waterfront in the morning in defiance against the union bosses. It's a brilliant ending. Brilliant.
What, so did he defy, did he not throw the fight?
He defied, well, that we never see him fight. Have you ever seen it, Lee?
I have seen it, yeah.
If you get a chance, revisit it. It's such a good film, revisit it, because you never see him fight as a boxer. He's an ex-boxer, but you find out through the famous I Could Have Been a Contender speech that he was forced by these gangsters to throw his fights to fail. And he could have been a contender for the world title there in Madison Square Garden, fighting properly to become a world champion. And they never let him. They used him, manipulated him. And as a consequence, he would have a total cushy job on the waterfront, never had to do any work. He was a pig, really, you know, but things changed throughout the story. Things change. I watched it recently with my wife. We watched it together about a few months ago, and we were just riveted. It's such a good story. And the acting is electric, you know, like Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb, not just Brando, even Marie Saint, everybody in it is brilliant in that film. Yeah. And the ending's brilliant. I love Carl Malden in it. He's as the tough priest, you know, not taking shit, trying to get Terry to change his ways. Come on, take a stand against these bastards. Take a stand against Johnny Friendly and his mob. We can do this together. You know, the idea of people power, together we can stand up against these bastards who are ripping you off. And Terry eventually does it, which brings all the workers on board then, you know, when he takes the stand. In the book, he does take the stand and he does go to court and shop Johnny Friendly and the other people. But they end up murdering him. And it's like, fuck. It's so dark. The book is fucking dark.
Yeah.
Because it's like he's calling Johnny Friendly out. He doesn't get into a fight with him. He says, Friendly, you bastard. Da, 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 da. And then it says a body was found a few months later inside a barrel. stabbed him multiple times. It's like, it's so horrific. And basically saying it was Terry. It was Terry. And in the book, Johnny Friendly doesn't get convicted of anything. And it's so bleak.
I bet you wish you never listened to it now.
Oh, my God. It's like, what am I? It's unbelievable. Because the film is kind of rousing the common people standing up against the bastards. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the book is bleak.
Yeah. Oh, God.
But I kind of loved it, though. I kind of love it. It's great. I'll have to lend it to you, Lee, because it's a really good listen. And yeah. That guy...
I don't know if I've got a tape player, though, Dave.
It's only me. Afraid. Archaic me. You know, I've still got, like, loads of vinyl. I even bought vinyl yesterday as well. Do you know what I bought as well?
Not a Lionel Blair album.
Oh, no, you're going to love this. I bought one of my, on eBay, one of my first albums that I ever owned because I'd lost it. I don't know where it was. And I thought, oh, I've got to.
Not on
have
the
this
buses, finish. Is it?
No, it's not.
Jasper
it's
Carrot.
Close. I would buy one of those Jasper Carrot albums. I bet they're quite
I've got a couple, I think.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, the nutter gets on the bus. It's even worse, Lee. I bought Jeff Love and his orchestra's James Bond themes, which was a massive album.
I remember having a Jeff Love cassette, actually.
Oh,
that had TV themes on it.
I've put in a bid on that. In fact, I better check eBay. I might have won that. Yeah, it's got things like the Carry On themes. It's got the Persuaders. And I bought it because I had that album. And it's kind of what... It's probably the thing that first really got me into music massively because I listened to Live and Let Die, Jeff Love's version of Live and Let Die, and it kind of like blew me away. And I used to dance around the living room like, you know, like a maniac to Live and Let Die, but not McCartney's original version, Jeff Love and his orchestra.
Jeff Love. I'm reading about him now.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm. I've actually got, I don't know how I came about it, I've got the Great Disaster Movies one. And I don't remember buying that. But I know that I got the Bond one for Christmas. And just was so good. And it, with my little mono record player. Oh, my God, I loved it. That's going to go on the record player in the next couple of days. And you know, and my car is full of tapes. Oh, another tape that I bought was a Sean Hudson book called the the artist fella fucking hell, what's the matter with me tonight? A few sips on Madry and my bloody brain cells have gone. What's he called? You're famous for 15 minutes.
Warhol.
Fucking hell, it's called The Warhol Effect, right?
Oh yeah.
And it's actually a pretty good story. Because it's the idea of despicable people, you know, Sean Hudson, you know, despicable people doing vile things so that they can be famous or infamous for 15 minutes, you know. So it segues into like this idea of spree killers and maybe like the Moors murderers. And then it goes on to tell this other story, this story that Hudson's invented, you know, the Sean Hudson story. And, it's basically about this guy who befriends this family, and he's holding within him this desire to just basically kill everybody he meets. So it's really good. But I kind of enjoyed it, you know, tootling around, listening to it. And what I thought was so funny was these two people that that read it. One of them is Amanda Redman. So Amanda Redman's reading most of it. But when there is this autobiographical side to the novel, which is talking about these real life crimes, it's been read by Sean Hudson himself, right? And I swear to you, it just made me laugh every time he came on because he sounds exactly like Garth Marenghi. His voice is, and then anyway, the killer came in with his hands covered in blood. He's just got this voice, this kind of monosyllabic voice, a little bit like Garth Marenghi. Well, he sounds a lot like I don't know if it's like the area, but the tone in his voice. Oh, it's amazing.
I was looking up Sean Hudson about a month ago because I did have a couple of his books in the 90s. I think one was called Renegades and the other was Captives, but I never got round to reading them though. I know my dad did and he said they were pretty good. The reason I was looking him up is I just finished listening to a James Herbert novel called The Jonah. Now, The Jonah, I don't know if you've read it, but that was one of the first novels I ever got when I was a teenager. But I never actually finished it. So I enjoyed listening to it on the audiobook. But yeah, so it got me thinking about Hudson, and because he was about then. But he's still going, Hudson. You know, he's still writing, which I was quite surprised at.
Well, this book, I mean, it's in the car, so I can't remember. I mean, it's either called the Warhol Prophecies.
Yeah, it is called that.
That's it, Warhol Prophecies. But I bought it through eBay on a whim. I thought I just want to have something to listen to aside from all the tapes. I've got loads of tapes still, so I've got loads of stuff to listen to anyway. Like, it's not Monty Python, Fawlty Towers, Partridge stuff, loads of stuff.
Have you still got that? Yes, Prime Minister. Audio book you nicked from.
Oh no, that wasn't. No, you see, that wasn't on tape. That was an easy pill for that. Because
where were we then? Was that where we went to Caldeen or somewhere?
Yeah. It was some like little. This is a local shop for local people, and I half inched this thing, but it was like this odd little thing, which was like a little tube. And it had the picture of Paul Eddington and whatever his name is, Fowler and blah, 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 the actor. Derek Folds, Nigel Hawthorne, Paul Eddington. Picture of them. Yes, Prime Minister. But it's like a little tube.
It was like an MP3, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like an MP3, but it had like four episodes of...
Came with headphones, yes, I remember.
Came with headphones. And I had another one. Of The Fog, James Herbert's The Fog. Yeah. I must have nabbed that as well. So I've listened to that, The Fog, and another one. What was the other one? The Rats.
Yeah, I've read The Rats. The Rats and The Fog.
So not read them, but listened to them. And thought they were quite... I thought The Rats was quite good. Thought The Fog dragged on a bit.
That was his first book, The Rats, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah. Wasn't The Fog? Is The Fog the same? Is it the same story like The Carpenter film?
No.
Is it not based on that? No.
No, it's different. It's different, and it's kind of more. I think it's from what I can vaguely remember, because I used to listen to it when I was falling asleep. So I don't know if I ever really heard it from start to finish properly, but I think it's more to do with a kind of like an industrial, chemicalized. Nothing. Whereas the Carpenter Fog is pure paranormal. This fog washes in off the ocean and it's full of ghosts of pirates. Beautiful. I think John Carpenter's The Fog, the idea of it's lovely. It's a pretty great film, actually.
Yeah.
You know, as most early Carpenter stuff is. Culminating in one of the best films of all time, which is The Thing. Just unbelievable film, The Thing, really. So good. But yeah, but I've listened to quite a lot of audiobooks. I've got like a couple of cricket things on in the car at the moment and blah, blah, blah. But I flick from the radio to that when I'm traveling about. But I thoroughly enjoyed the On the Waterfront one most of all, I think. That was really good. You know, it's a brilliant. If you get a chance to hear that. And the same company does, I think it's Peter Capaldi reading, wait for this, Don't Look Now, and The Birds. Oh, I so want to get that. So Daphne du Maurier's Don't Look Now and The Birds on the same audio.
Did she write The Birds? Cassette.
She did indeed, yeah. Mm. She did The Birds and Don't Look Now. She's an amazing writer, du Maurier.
Yeah, I've always wanted to read some du Maurier because she does a few ghosty type stories, don't she?
Oh yeah, I've read that. I had it and I don't know what's happened to it now. But when I went to Venice, I had with me
her book of short stories, one of which, of course, was Don't Look Now, and it was called Don't Look Now and Other Stories by Daphne du Maurier. That was a reprint. Mm. And it had a couple of other stories on it that were also absolutely fabulous. But what struck me in reading Don't Look Now was that it was word for word verbatim for the film.
Right.
It kind of thought, oh, it's not going to be as kind of strange and unusual as the film. It is. It is.
Mm,
it's brilliant. Incredible. What she's written is the film. It's just that Nick Rogue has embellished it with all these amazing shots and all these visual effects. But Nick Rogue has hardly tampered with the story. It's all there in du Maurier's writing. She's amazing. Very dark, you know. And I don't know if you've ever seen Rebecca, but Rebecca's brilliant.
The one with the
Yeah. It's great. It's a bit melodramatic. Joan Fontaine's a bit melodramatic, but the story's great.
Won the Oscar, as did On the Waterfront.
It did indeed. It did indeed. I did attempt to read Rebecca, though, you know, one time. I did get into, like, about 40 or 50 pages, but I'm a bit of a bugger with that with fiction, though. I can start with, when it comes to autobiographies and things like that, I can read them cover to cover. Like, I read Alan Godfrey's book on UFO. And of course, Lee, that is autobiographical. Every word of that is true.
Yeah. The audiobook I'm listening to now is this autobiography by Mickey Bereny. Now, do you know who Mickey Bereny is?
Is he a relative of Mickey Spillane?
No. Mickey Bereny, that was a terrible joke. Is the singer, or was the singer and guitar player from the band Lush.
Oh, really?
Do you remember Lush?
I remember Lush, yeah.
Yeah. So I was quite into Lush when they first came out. I remember buying a couple of their early EPs, which I've still got. So they were part of this scene that was called shoegaze, which was a bit of a derogatory term because some journalist came up with it because he said the bands, I think there's two meanings to it. One is that they're constantly looking at their effects pedals because it's very sort of dreamy type music, quite ethereal. Yeah. And the other reason is that they can't interact with the audience because they're so introverted. So they just look at the shoes all the time. But it's a brilliant book. It's one of the best music biographies I've ever read, actually.
I feel jealous and somewhat underwhelmed with myself because I should be reading much more than I do. I really should.
Another book I've read, which I would recommend, is Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian.
Oh!
Now, it's a brutal book.
Some of his work is, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, wow. I mean, The Road and bloody No Country for Old Men. They are...
Writing is incredible, though. I couldn't believe it when I started reading it, how good the writing was. It's about these, like, scalp hunters in the 1800s, you know, going across Southern America, you know, towards Mexico. And they're just slaughtering Indians on the way and other... If they come across anyone, the natural instinct is just to slaughter them. But the way he describes it is amazing. And it is lauded now as one of the best American novels ever.
Well, they say that now about Cormac McCarthy in general, don't they? He's regarded as the great American modern writer, isn't he? With things like The Road and No Country for Old Men and the book you mentioned, you know. But that story, which is interesting, as soon as you started talking about that, about going across country, brutalising Indians and just murdering them in the most horrific way, it makes me think in reverse the film Bone Tomahawk. Have you seen Bone Tomahawk?
No.
I may have mentioned it before.
Well, in fairness, the Indians are just as savage in the book. Yeah. You know, they do some horrific things.
Well, this is the idea of Bone Tomahawk, really, is that the Indians in this are almost like primeval. You know, they really are like almost like Neanderthal, and they haven't developed. It's basically suggesting there was like a tribe of Indians that hadn't developed as much as, say, the Sioux or the Apaches and whoever, and they were almost like Neanderthal cave-dwelling, but absolutely cannibalistic and psychopathic and everything. And it is unbelievably, it's got a couple of the most brutal scenes you'll ever see, honestly. I'm not going to say any more than that. get a chance to see it, because I couldn't believe what I was watching. But it's that far. But it's pretty brilliant. It's Kurt Russell again. And it's got two of the greatest American actors right out there. Kurt Russell and Richard Jenkins.
Yeah,
Richard Jenkins is such a great actor. Oh, my God. How brilliant was he as Jeffrey Dahmer's dad? He's amazing in the Shape of Water. He's amazing in Nightmare Alley. He's amazing in this. And he's a chameleon. He's such a different... He's able to shapeshift as an actor, I think. He's a brilliant actor.
Did you watch the Dahmer thing on Netflix? Did you watch it all?
I didn't. I haven't to this day seen all of it.
No, I got about halfway through it. I just lost interest, to be honest.
Most things on Netflix do that to me. I just can't see them through. I don't know what it is. I to be honest with you, we've given up the subscription on it now this month. Yeah, getting rid of it. And I have to say, my fine sir, segueing off into a different subject here, we thought we had midweek, cancelled our television licence.
For reinstating Gary Lineker?
Well, it was partly to do with the Lineker thing, but it was not really the Lineker thing. It was the absolute overt conservative Toryism at the top of the BBC.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The guy who donated nearly half a million.
The part of the problem is the Lineker thing highlighted the fact that both Tim Davey and Richard Sharp, right, are massive Tories who have been put in there by Tories. And then there's another guy who fucks around with the journalistic content in there. It's been completely taken over. And I were like, well, let's get rid of it. Fuck it.
Ironically, the Tories think it's left-wing, don't they? They think it's run by the liberal left-wingers.
Who are they kidding? They've got Laura Koonsberg and Andrew fucking Neil and people like that. Horrible right-wing bastards, you know. And then they've got these people that are instating it. I'm sick of it being used. And to be honest with you, same with Labour Party with it. I know that they install people who are left-leaning. Sick of it being used as like a bloody political tool, really. And it's getting less and less important to most people's lives. They haven't got anything on. And they can't opinionate. They say they can't opinionate, but when a royal member of the royal family dies, they fucking cry on TV. Like you've got Nicholas Witchell there, who's the most obscene fucking royalist human cunt there is. And they say that they don't opinionate. They opinionate constantly about the worst kind of parasitical toffs that this country has.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be neutral.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were very, very, very clear. And it's only because George overheard it and was getting a bit worried that we were going to get in trouble. And I'm saying, we won't get in trouble, son. We won't. They can't come in the house. They can't check your devices. And we won't watch it anyway. If you're not watching anything live, and you're watching streaming services that aren't live, they can't do you for anything. They can't do you for having a telly nowadays.
Well, apparently, if they see you watching summer and it's like terrestrial TV, they do issue a fine. They don't have to come in. But you've just got to make sure the TV's not on. Or just don't answer the door to people you don't know.
You've seen our house, haven't you, Lee? So we've got a gated drive. To go and see any of our tellies, you'd have to go round the back of the house, which is really trespassing.
Yeah.
So I'd set the dog on them for that, right? And they wouldn't see that. And the chances are that them ever seeing anything live from the BBC would be like a million to one shot, because I don't even watch, like you say about the news, I do watch Channel 4 news, but I tend to watch that on catch up a bit later on. So that's not live. No. The BBC news.
I think the rule is if you've got equipment that actually can mean that you get terrestrial TV. So if they see you've got an aerial and they see that it's plugged into the back of your TV, I think they'll do you.
They will. Well, as it happens, we still have it. We haven't got rid of it now because.
Right. What was George bothered about? Was he?
Well, again, this is the awful thing of it. It's like, oh, breaking the law, we're going to break the law, we're going to get in trouble, get fined, breaking the law. So it's not against the law. You don't have to have one. It's not against the law. It's just being prepared to be different. Mm. You can listen to the radio. You can listen to any radio as long as you're not listening to the BBC. It's bullshit. Yeah. You know, I'm getting really sick of it. But I do appreciate that the problem with the BBC is that all the right-wing scumbag bastard and fucking horrible right-wing press in Britain wants to get rid of the BBC. And I know that there's a problem there. I don't necessarily want there not to be a state broadcaster. I just don't want it to be run the way it is. And it's just, it's very slimy, I think. And maybe there isn't a need for it anymore because there's plenty of independent things that have different opinions. Look at LBC. LBC isn't part of the BBC. What they have is some incredibly different thinking people on there. Very left wing and very...
Doesn't Farage do her?
Hey, he don't work for them anymore, but they did have Farage on there. They had
Farage I don't mind that. I mean, you know, I don't mind that. Want to listen to one side all the time.
No, I don't.
You know, let's have good. Both sides or anyone.
It's good that Farage was on there because when he actually ended up having a conversation with James O'Brien, James O'Brien wiped the floor with him.
He gets on the nerves, James O'Brien.
He gets on my
nerves. Very so sure he's always right.
He is, and he's very egotistical. He's very sure he's right.
Actually wrote a book called How to Be Right.
I know he has.
Fucking hell.
They've got another guy on there I love. I think I may have mentioned him before. He's got a guy on there called Nick Abbott. I think he's excellent to listen to. He's very funny. But we need people like Nick Abbott and James O'Brien. And he's got a very big listenership. Because they do, what he is doing is bringing power to book. You know, he's challenging the status quo. He's challenging what's happening because we're up against it with the right wing. So it's important to have that, you know, because we're going to find ourselves in a lot of shit if we don't make some big moves. You know, look what's happened. Most of the news coverage, even like Channel 4, they hardly mentioned the fucking doctor's strike. That was a massive thing that we had a strike, a doctor's going on strike. And it was almost like, oh, let's try and brush it under the carpet. I think that was very cleverly done. Yeah. I think that was actually the BBC themselves thinking, we're not going to overemphasize that. It might piss them off, might piss the Tories off. I don't know what I'll do, to be honest with you, Lee. If the Tories get in power again, I'll be the first one, as you know, that if Starmer gets in power, and they're making a pig's ear of it, I'll be shouting from the rooftops, get rid of him, he's a fucking waste of space. I'm not a massive fan of him. To me, he's too moderate.
Yeah. But
surely we need a change now. And this fella, he's like a fucking children's television presenter. This Sunak.
Rishi Sunak.
Oh, he's hopeless, isn't he?
Well, this is it, Dave. I've not been following what's been going on.
Well,
in the past
good
few
for
months.
You. In a way, you're right, Lee. It's absolutely right. You know, should shut the doors on it. This is what I will do. If there is a continuation of what we've got, that will be it. I will just, if not leave the country, as in Britain, I will pull the shutters down on current affairs altogether. Just want to listen to it. Fuck it.
So, can I ask, have you got Disney Plus?
Yes!
Right, okay. So, one show I've just finished watching on there, going off the last pod, is War of the Worlds.
Oh, you were saying about this.
Yeah, which is starring Gabriel Byrne. It's a modern, updated version. Now, it's all right. I mean, it is a bit pedestrian and very dark, which I don't mind, obviously. It's nothing really like the H.G. Wells, because I was hoping for tripods, you know, some decent-looking tripods.
Yeah.
But what you do get is these mechanical dogs, which are actually real things. I don't know if you've seen latest robotic what do they call these robotic dogs?
Yeah, I know what you mean. They're kind of like a dog version of a drone, aren't they? They on the ground, move around and simulate the movement of a dog, don't they?
Yeah, so that's a good aspect of it, really, because it's better than CGI. But the story itself is actually a time travel thing. So the aliens are actually humans, which is a bit disappointing. But they come back and they just want to wipe us out. Now, within the story, the whole story is based on this, like, what they would call a time loop. And I can't really get my head around it. So I'll give you a similar one. You know, in Terminator, so Arnie comes back to try and kill Sarah Connor, who's going to have a baby, John Connor, right? And Reese, Kyle Reese comes back, doesn't he, as well, to protect Sarah Connor. But he fathers John Connor, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's like a ghost fucking her.
Yeah. How does that actually work?
It doesn't, you know, does
because it? Obviously he was friends with John Connor in the future. So he it's came back. Well, I don't know. I'm sure. So we're like, the late Stephen Hawking could try and explain
it. Figure it out.
But it's the same thing in this. It sort of tainted it a little bit because it was just quite unsatisfying. I hope someone has got an explanation that makes sense. But on the face of it, it doesn't.
It's amazing, though, how they do this. They fuck around with a good story, don't they?
Mm.
You know, I don't know if they've ever just tried to do what Jeff Wayne did and just do a version of War of the Worlds based entirely on H.G. Wells' book, right, set in the same period of time, you know, just...
Well, they did that. The BBC did that, and it was crap.
They did. But they mucked about with it, though. It wasn't the story. I thought it was a great idea. Yes, they're going to do it in this Victorian age, and it comes down these tripods, and yes. But they pissed around with it.
Yeah.
It wasn't right. Whereas Wayne got it, he just thought, I'm going to tell H.G. Wells' story and put loads of modern music to it. Great.
Have a look what you think of this this modern War of the Worlds. It's not bad. You know, it's all right.
I just worry, Lee, it's a series, and the only one I'm investing any time in at the minute, a little bit, is because we're all sitting down together as a family and watching it, including, you know, George, because he's not watching loads with us these days because he's got his bass guitar now and he's really good. Oh, mate, and he's good, nice, you know.
One. Daisy plays the drums now.
Does she? That's
well, she's not got a drum kit, but she was asked to join a band and she just said, I've had about 5 lessons.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, George just did his first gig, which was just playing, him and his mate playing Supersonic by Oasis.
He's learned how to play the bass.
Yeah, and he
inherited your musical talent.
Well, dare I say. But, I mean, he did it very quickly as well. And he's got a left-handed bass because he's lefty. So he's like Macca, Paul McCartney, left-handed bass player. And he picked it up quick. And his mate Frank's good little guitarist. And they did a good job on it. It was good.
Nice.
You know, and he's picking up loads of riffs now. He's even starting to learn Money by Pink Floyd. Yeah, and he's doing it well. I'm dead impressed. But anyway, so he'll sit down and watch The Last of Us with us.
Oh, yeah. Is that any good?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It's okay. It's a bit, you know.
I've got the computer game.
It's a bit Walking Dead, to be honest.
That's what I mean. And I suppose this one is a bit Walking Dead War of the Worlds because it's just about a group of survivors.
I love the, you know, the old idea of a sort of apocalyptic nightmare. I'm a big fan of that. I love watching that. But there's only so many.
Done to death, though, now.
It has been done to death. For me, really, what I only want to do is watch good films. I want to invest in watching good films if I can. Because life is, you know, finite. And these box sets, they're just...
They rarely pay off. The investment doesn't usually match the payoff, does it?
They don't, and I think they're a part of like a fucking capitalist cabal. They're trying to get you in there, aren't they? They're trying to suck you into what they're doing. And half of it, it starts off, some of it has got a lot of artistic merit, and then it just goes into a fucking long-winded, drawn-out fart. You know, they're just feeding you shit, and it just goes on too long.
Yeah.
We watched, like, Jackie and I watched, like, 7 series, 8 series of The Walking Dead. And we're like, what the fuck are we doing now? The first 3 series, yeah, great, very interesting. But it's fuck off.
Yeah, we ended up abandoning it. I think we got a bit further, probably about series 10.
How long are you going to just carry on this pantomime with this Negan guy? Yes, he's a twat. He really annoys me now. Kill him. Just kill the fucker. Get rid of it, because it's just back and forth, tit for tat.
Well, you know what was worrying at that time, Dave, when it was about season 10, and it is getting a bit tedious. I heard that the showrunners were saying we're only halfway through.
Oh, fuck.
I'm saying, fuck's sake, surely you're taking the piss now. But I remember we were watching it, and you do reach that point, don't you, where you look at each other and go, this is total shit. I'm not wasting any more time.
What are we doing?
Especially like, at the time, we were putting ourselves through the annoying buffering because we were watching it like on a an illegal channel. or you know what I mean? Yeah. You have that app, Cyberflix or something, and you have to go through the fucking rigmarole of trying to find a decent stream, and it just constantly buffs. So you say, oh, God, no, I'm not buffing that. Yeah.
Well, we've just renewed our dodgy system, and it's fucking playing up. But you can watch the live stuff on it, so you can watch the cricket and the darts and all that and things like that. But the bloody archive that I've built on there, I've built this great archive of films and television stuff, mainly films. You should see my list of films. They're fabulous. You know, I'm so proud of it because it's got things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on there, The Godfather Trilogy, Birdman of Alcatraz, Soylent Green, you know, classic films. Can't get any of them bloody working at the moment because it's just buffering like mad. But then again, we've still got Disney Plus, which we don't pay for. But it's not illegal what we've done. I don't think it's illegal. We've been we're sharing it with maybe that is illegal, but we're sharing it with somebody else. So it's very nice. Quite right, too. Who wants to give Disney any fucking money? Fuck off. You know, worst capitalist in the world. Horrible fucking anthropomorphizing bastards. They really are.
I had a good time there last year, Dave, but I know what you mean. Like being trapped in.
Sorry, mate. I know
trapped
you went there.
In the walled city of Disney. Yeah,
well, let's be honest, you had an awful lot to say about going to
I did
Disneyland.
Actually. I forgot about that. I really did moan about it, didn't I?
That was brilliant, though. I loved that. I was rejoicing on that. That's exactly how I would have been. I just think it's great if we can encourage people to get back to watching films because, you know, and there's so many good old films. You know, try revisiting. I know I'm such a retrograde, regressive bastard going on about me tapes. me tapes and stuff. It is amazing when you sit down and you watch some films from the past and you go, wow, you know. Yeah. We watched Birdman of Alcatraz, Jackie and I, the other day, and you know, obviously, Jackie's a big bird watching fan. I said, "You want to watch this? If you've never seen it. The story of this guy, you know, this lifer in prison who became this massive expert on the well-being of small birds and stuff." And, oh wow, you know, it's an incredible film. You know that is.
Yeah. One thing I did want to talk about, Dave, is last week I went to see an AC/DC tribute band called.
Oh, you were telling me. Yes, you mentioned something on the
and. A few weeks before that, I saw a Smiths tribute band. So it's the second time I've seen a Smiths tribute band. I just think tribute bands are absolutely brilliant. You know, you pay, what, 20 quid? It's usually quite an intimate, small venue. So you've got this, like, Angus guy. The guy's playing Angus. He's twice as big and he's dead skinny.
Yeah.
But what a guitar player. Oh, my God. He was amazing. And then Brian Johnson comes on. He was like the image of Brian Johnson, and his voice was brilliant as well. He sounded actually better than Johnson does now, because unfortunately his voice has gone. He sounds more like Donald Duck now.
It's brilliant. I have to say, Lee, I don't know if you know this, but a few years ago, I went to a night at a fantastic place, a very famous venue near to these parts called the Tivoli in Buckley. They put on a lot of different bands. I saw the Charlatans there last year. It's not this like the club I used to run, the Brickhouse nightclub in Manchester. I was licensee there for 12 years, as you know. But it's a bigger place. But it just reminds me a little bit of the Brickhouse. And we went to this night, Jackie, myself, and two other couples who are friends of ours locally, and it was amazing. It was three indie tribute bands. Right, the Smiths, Oasis, and the Stone Roses. I can't remember what they called themselves.
Was it the Clone Roses and Oasis?
Yeah, it's something like that.
Yeah, the Smiths ones I've seen are Smiths Limited and the Smiths with a Y.
Right, the Smiths guy, what I can tell you is, I can't remember what he called himself, but he's the guy who performed as Morrissey on stars in their eyes. Right.
Did somebody do that? Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Have to look this up.
And he was really good. He really sounded like Morrissey. It was brilliant. And Oasis, the guys who did it with Oasis, they were great too. I mean, this was one night. This was one night. It's like Smiths, Oasis, Stone Roses, right? But the Stone Roses tribute band were fucking awesome.
Because, really? I thought you were going to say they were fucking shit. Cocky bastards.
What was great about the Stone Roses band is the guitarist was as good as John Squire, right?
Yeah.
The drummer was fucking amazing. It was like you're watching it going, wow. But what topped it off was the singer could fucking sing. So it didn't sound like Ian Brown, you know, mumbling out of key, you know. And oh, God, and a drone. This guy was great. The songs sounded amazingly, amazing.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've seen loads of tribute bands. I go to this festival every year, which has a load of them on. And I'm always massively impressed how good they are. Oh, you know, they're amazing musicians.
Yeah, I think
they do this stuff.
I'd love to go and see something like that again, because it was a really good night out there. It was great. And do you know what? I don't think we paid more than like 15 quid or something for the ticket.
You know, would you rather see the Stone Roses in like a football stadium or see a band like them in a club? You know, it's a much better experience, isn't it?
Well, I tell you something, pal. It's disgusting. The other day, a good friend of ours locally, and they're big Wrexham supporters, and they were putting it out there, oh, you know, Kings of Leon are playing at Wrexham's grounds, you know, the race course, and, you know, should we go down, blah, blah, blah. I thought, oh, you know, that might be a laugh, you know, great. Let's go down and look at that. 80 quid they wanted for a ticket.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the Kings of Leon, they're all right. But the fucking... We went to see Paul Weller last year, Jackie and I. It was half that price. You're telling me the fucking Kings of Leon have got the tunes that Paul Weller's got?
Well, I think it's probably to do with a venue that they can play. I think
generally,
football stadium gigs, they are around that price. Though I bought some Arctic Monkeys ones for my daughter. They were 60 quid, actually.
Well, we went to see...
Well, 80 quid, yeah. I mean, that is steep for the Kings of Leon.
I think we paid the same price, or maybe 60 quid. I don't know, because Jackie bought it. It was my birthday present, really, last year. But it was Noel Gallagher. And the same group that we went to watch at the TIV, that was our friends Martin and Beth and Russ and Lowry. And we went to watch Noel Gallagher. And it was, I'm pretty sure it was about, I think it was 50 quid. It's like 10 quid more. And it's Noel Gallagher. And at the end, he sings all the fucking Oasis songs. But 82 quid a ticket to go and see the Kings of Leon. I think they're taking the piss. I really do. I'm sorry. So we just said, no, we're not doing it. We're not going to do it.
Well, it's all the fees on top as well. You don't know what the Ticketmaster and that are adding on these days. Because I was reading something today about The Cure. I think it was some American gig. And it was more than the actual cost of the tickets.
Really? Right, so well, good for Robert Smith pointing out like, we don't want to be part of that, because I'm sure he doesn't. I mean, Robert Smith's made probably a lot of money over the years, and I'm sure he doesn't want to be ripping his fans off, you know.
Who was it slagging off Robert Smith the other day?
I read that Paul Weller, you know, talking about going to see Paul Weller, and it was a great gig, you know, but I was very disappointed to hear that he was just horrendous about Robert Smith, really.
Was it Paul Weller then?
It might have been Paul Weller, but I don't know if he said it the other day.
He called him a fat cunt.
Yeah, he said, I don't have anything to do with that fat cunt. And he was really rude. I said, come on, Paul, come on. He's written some bloody great songs. This is one of the great modern songwriters, you know. And so are you. You shouldn't be talking about...
No, it's probably some bad blood there. But that reminds me, Dave, talking of Paul Weller, guess who was supporting the Smiths Limited?
Oh, was it Paul Weller tribute, the Jam?
No, it wasn't.
Jams.
It was someone doing a DJ set, and they used to do a DJ set, I believe, in a rival club of yours, Dave.
Oh, really?
So who was the rival indie club in Manchester?
The rival indie club, what, 42s?
No. Or,
South?
Yeah.
South, okay. Clint so Boone?
Clint Boone, yeah. Right. I've got to tell you. The connection between Paul Weller is he's basically got one of those Paul Weller-esque haircuts.
Yeah.
Hasn't it? Guys over 50 who have those Paul Weller haircuts, they're known as Wellends.
Wellends, they are fucking Wellends.
But he was trying to whip up the crowd, right? And he kept just shouting, Boone Army, Boone Army. Oh. But nobody was interested or paying attention. I think he went away quite crestfallen after his set. You know.
I remember one time, I don't like calling names, but I'm going to do it. Fuck it, I don't care. One time when Mike Joyce was DJing for us at the club. Mm. And it was literally like 40 people in there, like an old man and his dog. You know, it wasn't full at all. He rocks in. I'd done his warm-up for the first hour. So he rocks in about 11:30 or whatever. And he comes in a little bit high as a kite, maybe been looking at some white powder somewhere. I don't know. I couldn't possibly say or speculate on that. I have no idea.
Doing his washing.
Yeah, doing his washing. Exactly, doing his washing. He comes in and he starts going, Mike Joyce in the house! Mike Joyce in the house! And nobody responded to it. They all just looked at him, what? You what? Fucking what?
Oh. One subject I wouldn't mind talking about, and we can probably do a bit tonight, Dave, is the old Britpop period. Because this book I'm reading of Mickey Bareny, who was in Lush, they sort of drifted into that. I mean, when they started out, they were quite a unique sound. They sounded more like the Cocteau Twins, and there's quite an ethereal sound, but they eventually morphed into quite a generic indie band.
Yeah,
which is when I sort of tuned out. But she talks a lot about the whole lad culture at that time and how difficult it was to be a female artist. I mean, she's not sort of one of these. She's not moaning about it. She's just saying that there was some behaviour that was really bad. But because it was, it was in that period of, get your tits out and all loaded. But I remember that. Do you remember it happening, this culture that just came in? It was all seemed to be centered around Chris Evans.
Oh, laddish culture was fucking dreadful, wasn't it?
Yeah,
because our George was saying the other day, he said, I wish I was around, because he's so into the whole Britpop thing, George, right? He's massive. But the Britpop thing, we were watching a documentary the other day about it, and it was talking about Suede, and it was talking about the evolution of Britpop, really. So it was talking about Suede, Blur. It started with Blur, then it was talking about Suede, how they sort of usurped Blur at the beginning and they became the big band. And it all kind of started because Nirvana were massive, and that whole kind of scene from Seattle was the kind of new thing. And Britain said, Britain bands are like, oh, come on, we got to do better than this. And Blur was sort of emerging, and then Suede took over, and Suede, you know, Brett Anderson and Bernard Butler were like massive, blah, blah, blah. And then going into Oasis and one thing or another. And it's a very interesting documentary, Channel 5, and they're running it over the next few weeks. So if you get a chance, see it, folks.
Yeah.
But George went, oh, God, I would have loved to have been around then. You know, it must have been great. I said, yeah, it was. It was good, but there was shit times too, mate. One of the things I probably should say is that you were either in it or you weren't, you know what I mean? And this kind of, it was really arrogant kind of scene. And you had all those magazines, didn't you? Like, was it Zoo? And what was the other, what are the ones? What was it? Loaded.
GQ.
You know, and all about, real laddism culture on it. Dead sexist. Top 100 fit birds of the year and all this kind of stuff. And I don't think it was very healthy. It wasn't very healthy for us, I don't think. Most of us around that time. But, interesting, but
Euro 96 was a big part of it as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Everybody definitely was getting into football. Oh, yeah, look, football. There's Gail Porter going to the pub with Dan Hipgrave from Top Loader to versus Holland.
A lot of girls just didn't do themselves any favours over it, though, did they, you know, as well? It has to be said. It wasn't just a lot. I mean, a lot of girls really sort of embraced it and went along with it.
Yeah, well, this is what Mickey Bareny's saying, is that you were just assumed that you would be like a lad. It was that ladette term, wasn't they?
That's it, ladette, yeah.
you know, for me, I remember at the time I was a bit older. Obviously, I was in my mid-20s when it was all kicking off. And I remember my sister, who's like 10 years younger than me, was like really into Oasis. And I thought it was great that guitar music had made a comeback. If you remember the early 90s chart music, it was absolutely full of these technotronic type.
Horrendous.
Utter shit. You know, if you watch Top of the Pops on BBC 4 on a Friday, it's covering that sort of period, isn't it? The early 90s.
Well, did you see that 88 or 89 when Morrissey released his first hit single, which Suede Head? And it was like higher than any. It went straight into the charts, higher than any Smith's single. And then gone. But it was like, kind of like a sore thumb against all the other stuff that was there.
Yeah.
The show was fucking dreadful. But I have to say, the video for that is hilarious. It's so shit.
Yeah.
Morrissey looks so awkward. Such a shit video.
I think he makes great videos, Morrissey.
But look what Suede Head
does. Yeah, that's not one of his best.
He's like sort of posing and gesticulating, you know, that's funny. Mm. But the some of the stuff on that chart, it just showed it was so fucking naff.
Jeez. Oh, terrible. It was all like one-hit wonders, wasn't it? It was just not real bands. They were just like some record execs that had got someone to mime to something. Was it Black Box that had that
guy? Yeah.
She wasn't the singer, was she?
Not at all. She was
actually put there. She was a Milli Vanilli type.
I'm sure effort. That she was part of the reason it was a hit, because as soon as they were on Top of the Pops, and she was quite attractive, let's say.
Yeah.
And then giving it to see.
Yeah, it's a good song. I wouldn't necessarily lump that in with the other.
Yeah, it kind of came out at the end of that, didn't it? It was quite a big dance tune. It wasn't like ultra pop. It wasn't sort of a Hitman and Her pop. Yeah,
but I'm talking about the Two Unlimited type.
Oh yeah.
Bollocks and
exactly.
Snap.
Oh yeah. I mean, the thing is a lot of. I mean, there's a lot of that where you really look at like Stock Aitken and Waterman, and you just want to.
Oh, those motherfuckers.
Motherfuckers. Motherfuckers. Oh dear. He's always did that horrible element in music, especially since that time. Since that time, there's been that horrible element in music where it's just about making a fucking fast buck in it.
Yeah.
And that's where you get Cowell, you know, afterwards. I mean, how the hell? What is that all about?
Well, I wonder if it was Cowell that killed Britpop.
Well, he might well have done. He probably
Zig
did.
And Zag and Robson and Jerome.
Yeah, he probably did. I mean, what a prick. I mean, he's the lowest form of fucking human, isn't he? He's awful. And the fact that people buy into his crap on these shows.
You get people going, oh, I always agree with what Simon says. You know, it elevates them.
Like he's some kind of man of wisdom. He's a fucking horrible double-dyed, fucking high pant wearing, fucking plastic surgery, fucking
what's he done to his face?
Nightmare.
He's had his eyes like half the size, aren't they? He's had them sewed up almost.
He's mentally ill. You can't do that to yourself and not be mentally ill. You've got to have some serious problems in your life. Your vanity has taken over your brain cells to such a degree that you have no common sense whatsoever left. Can't look in the mirror and think he looks good. He cannot. Yeah. You got to think he looks in the mirror and thinks, I am a fucking monstrosity. What have I done? I am, exactly. I mean, John Merrick looks like Cary Grant compared to him. He's a disgrace.
I remember when Oasis came out, and because they were from Burnage, where I was from, yeah, I felt really proud, you know, that a band had emerged from Burnage. And I remember seeing them on The Word. I think it was the first TV appearance when they played Supersonic.
Yeah, it was an amazing performance.
I remember thinking, fucking hell, that is a band. They really blew me away.
Yeah, blew me away. They were great. And they were, but the thing is, they did work really hard on it. They really, really honed what they were doing. They were the hardest working band, apparently. They rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. This documentary points that out. It's fantastic.
Really? Well, that's surprising, that.
Yeah, they worked really hard. I mean, most of the others didn't work as hard as Oasis. They really did work at it. They had that kind of northern grit. We're going to work and pound this until it's absolutely spot on. So fair play to them. Fair play.
People sort of say to me, oh, you grew up in Burnage. Do you remember Oasis? I do remember seeing Liam with a skinhead because his school, you know, Barlow was very near where I lived. But I do remember fucking Paul and Noel nicking our football.
Really?
Paul, when I say Paul, I mean the older Gallagher brother, Paul Gallagher.
Yeah, Paul Gallagher.
Yeah, he was a right twat.
But the fat,
we were in
the fat one.
We're in Fog Lane Park. Yeah. And they just sort of like, oh, can we play? And I just remember it quite vividly. And just remember him just running away with the ball, the bastard.
What a twat. Yeah, I've heard of some rumours about them being pretty bloody horrible, especially Liam. I think he was a nasty bully at school, apparently.
One of my friends went to school with him, actually, but she said he was never there.
Well, yeah. Mm.
But what other bands do you remember from that era, Dave?
Let's put it this way. The bands that I really look at now and I like most of all from that period, really, is I do like Blur a great deal. You know, I do think their body of work stands up better than most from that period, actually, when you listen back to it. For me, I mean, Oasis stuff, the best of Oasis is amazing, but a lot of it is Moon, June, Spoon in it. A lot of it is not the best, I don't think. Some of it, like, you know, the early stuff, Definitely Maybe, is a great album. But I think Blur made two or three great albums, like Modern Life is Rubbish, Part Life is a great album, The Great Escape, you know, they've done some good stuff. Because I've listened to quite a bit to The Great Escape recently, and it's quite poppy, but they're actually really interesting, some of the songs. It's the lyrics, I think, as well. They're lifted by Albarn's lyrics are far better than Noel's, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And Super Furries, as I said, was a great band.
Oh, yeah, they were good. Thing.
I quite like Pulp. It's difficult for me because I kind of morph in bands like The Charlatans as well. They were earlier, of course.
Yeah.
Because at that time, the 90s was a lot of the start of the Brick House for me when I think about it. So it was mixing in the new Britpop stuff with the older stuff together.
Yeah.
To me, it's the indie scene, you know. Elastica were good, weren't they? Elastica were part of that.
Shed 7, I don't mind some of their stuff.
Yeah, a little bit of Shed 7. I just think, yeah, they're okay.
Skunk and Nancy.
Skunk and Nancy. I like Skunk and Nancy a lot. They were really good. It's interesting you put them in the Britpop scene because, you're right too.
I think they were part of what was known as the Brit Rock scene.
Yeah.
Of course, like, magazines like Kerrang started to cover them. And another great band from that time that I still like, they're not Britpop, is Censor. I don't know if you've listened to
remember. Censor.
Yeah.
Baby Bird, man, they only had one big hit, didn't they, really? And
what, Baby Bird? You're Gorgeous.
Yeah, they're part of the Brit sort of scene, though. So they reckon. Was Divine Comedy Britpop? Yeah, Divine Comedy. Because I think the Britpop scene was anything that had a kind of British lilt to it, a kind of eccentric Britishness about it was part of the whole thing, wasn't it? So, you know, like Pulp, you know, Pulp very much.
Yeah.
I like Pulp. Like, I have these debates with George because he said, I don't really like Pulp, don't really get what they're about. I said, well, you know, I think he was a good performer and interesting lyricist, Jarvis, and some of the songs are really good. He said, I like Babies, you know, and Disco 2000, but I don't really like Common People, he said. I don't like Ease and Whiz. I personally think they're all good, then. I think they're all good songs myself.
What's that song Jarvis Cocker released a few years ago? The world is run by cunts or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, cunts are still running the world.
Yeah. I tell you what, some of his solo stuff is great. Some of the lyrics are brilliant, you know. Yeah. Good.
Yeah, the person I remember around that time championing a lot of these bands was Gary Crowley. Do you remember him?
Oh, God, yeah.
I think he was a really genuine fan of the music, and he was, you know, he was about well before Britpop.
I tell you what, going back to what you're saying, though, about Evans, I look back at it now and think, he's a fucking prick, you know. I can't be. I know he had his big shows and they were very successful, and Don't Forget Your Toothbrush and all that, Big Breakfast.
Never watched that.
I don't know. What was the one he did on a Friday?
CFI Friday.
Yeah. He really, but he makes himself out of this humble guy now and all that. Oh, but he really was a bit of a sleazeball, I think, during the Britpop period, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I might be wrong. I don't know.
No, he was a proper twat then. Yeah. He even admitted it, didn't he?
I'm not a massive fan. That whole kind of gobby fucking radio DJ thing.
Yes.
Moyles and all that lot. I'm not a fan.
Oh, Moyles, God.
The only one of them lot that I had a little bit of a soft spot for was Steve Wright. Actually, I thought he was all right. Yeah, I don't know. I think with me is it's like I probably never thoroughly embraced the whole Britpop thing when I look back on it.
No,
you know, I mean, I went to a couple of festivals. I remember like V97 being a very good festival, and I suppose you could also say that, you know, Verve were like a massive Britpop band, weren't they?
Yeah.
So they were pretty good. But when I saw them live, I thought they was dull as ditch water.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were really shit, right at the height of their fucking power, really. There was nothing wrong with it, what they did in the performance, but it just didn't, I don't know, because the records were great.
Yeah.
I love like Lucky Man and The Drugs Don't Work and all that. I thought that there's lots of good stuff from them, but it didn't help really. I'd just been watching James Brown perform before going to watch The Verve, and there's no comparison. You can't
compete.
I mean, James Brown and his band were amazing, fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And then you go off to watch The Verve, but anyway, there you are.
It's a very interesting period, and it, like I say, it was good that guitar music had made a comeback.
I think what was really good about the period, it was a good part of, you know, I had, certainly especially towards the mid part of the whole Britpop scene, I had a sort of an interesting, fun time of it. So it was an exciting time, and I suppose the whole Oasis Blur thing was very exciting as well at the time. And, you know, and it was a time in Britain where we thought, yeah, things are good.
You had that optimism, didn't you? And we were all, I don't know, it seems horrible now that you think about it, how enthused we were by Tony Blair.
It is. And we might feel that way again because we're going to be coming out, hopefully, next year, of a period of a long run of conservatism like we were when Blair got in.
Yeah.
And there was a feeling of renewal. There was a feeling of something new, especially for younger people, like younger people. So the 90s had that swinging 60s feel where suddenly when Wilson came in power and young people suddenly had a bit of money in their pocket, it was about youth. It was about young people being inventive and creating and one thing or another. And the 90s was the same. The music was exciting and interesting. We had some great bands and it was an exciting time for young people.
But let's not erase from our minds the horrible image of things can only get better at the Labour Party conference.
Which I have to say as well, was Brian Cox never performed on, for fuck's sake? He wasn't in D Ream when that happened.
Was he not? No. Well, Brian Cox was in this band from Rochdale called Dare. He was in this like soft rock band with Darren Wharton, who was the keyboard player in Thin Lizzy.
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I was watching a bit of Thin Lizzy before we started this. It was a funny clip where Frank Carson's in this pub and he introduces Thin Lizzy.
That's great.
Right. Darren Wharton's there on keyboards. But Phil Lynott just can't. He just doesn't look like his arse. He doesn't put much effort into the singing. But yeah, so what's his face? Cox was the keyboardist for there before he was in D Ream.
That is interesting. I wasn't sure if he was in D-Ream after 97 for a period. I don't know.
I don't know when he was in it. But
I don't know. I don't think he was there. I don't think he was with them when that became the
No, you're right. Because funnily enough, that came on the telly. Talking about Top of the Pops on a Friday night, that came on the telly and it was played in consecutive episodes and he wasn't there.
He wasn't there, was he? Mm. No, I remember seeing that myself. But it was an exciting time. And when Blair first got in, it was like new beginnings, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, we need that feeling. We need, especially younger people, I think, need that feeling in Britain that we need to have something new, something vibrant. We're not going to get it in the music scene, though, I don't think, because the music scene, and this is where my son's comment was quite poignant, because he can't see that. He can't see how there's going to be like this vibrant new music scene with bands and stuff. And it's a sad thought, really, because it's harder. There are great bands, but they don't get the kind of profile
that
they would in the past. There are great bands today, probably bands as good as Blur and Oasis, but they don't get the profile.
Because who are the indie bands these days? I can't really think.
I see some good things on Jules Holland. I see some good bands, but I can't remember the name of them because they don't get the exposure, do they? It doesn't get out there. But what there is, Lee, which is I think is really interesting, and maybe there's some way we should get on the bandwagon of this. There's definitely an undercurrent of lads, maybe in particular lads. I don't know. It could be girls as well. But there's an undercurrent of a real interest in that period of time, the music from that time,
yeah.
The Blurs, the Oasis. I bet Daisy's kind
yes,
of interested.
Yes, she is. She likes a lot of that.
It isn't just lads. Period. It's Daisy as well. Yeah. They're realising, they're going...
They're lucky, aren't they? They're lucky that they've got a few decades. I mean, we had, 60s, 70s, and to sort of look back at, that was what we look back at. But they've got another two or three decades on top.
Yeah.
Discover.
Well, we had true. We had the 60s and 70s. And in the 80s, there was a few shining lights, particularly the Smiths, you know, who were great bands. There wasn't a lot in the 80s, but there was some good stuff. You know, I would always argue there was some good stuff.
Well, there was loads of good stuff in the, you know, in the metal scene. And that's some of my favourite bands.
Yeah,
today.
Sorry, mate. I'm just thinking of that, like alternative rock. Or indie rock. We should just call it alternative rock, should we? Not fucking indie rock. I get bored of this term indie because it's not really the reality. It's alternative pop and rock. It's all pigeonholing music anyway. It's good music and bad music in there. There's been plenty throughout the decades. But today, it doesn't get the exposure because the computer generation has seen the end of that. And it's seen the end of monetizing music as well, which is very difficult for people.
I think what obviously helped a lot of the bands in them days is you did have a lot more music shows on TV, didn't you?
Absolutely.
You had like the chart show, which was, you know, I never really liked the chart show. I always thought they had a patronising attitude towards rock music. You know, they'd have to do the rock chart, but they'd always show a fucking Bon Jovi video rather than, you know, like an Anthrax one. They'd cut it short as well. There were so many more late night music shows that you'd sit up and watch. And there just isn't that anymore. No one seems that interested in promoting new bands on the telly and giving them the exposure.
This is the thing that's a little bit worrying as well, because for the likes of us, to reflect is a great thing and it's lovely. And it's great for younger people to reflect. But if they're reflecting but have got... But they can't find a way to be enthusiastic about their ambition. It's a different kettle of fish. We could reflect and still go, oh, but we've got a chance to do our own thing. There was still a possibility, a slim one, but there was still a possibility. But I think it must be quite hard today because you think, well, how can I be that now? Because there isn't the platform. Go on a fucking Britain's Got Talent thing. And try and do an original song and get that fucking cunt in your claws. No, you know, oh, God, imagine it.
That's the root.
That's the root. I'm interested in what you're doing, but and then he'll get you in a studio and he'll just destroy what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Just destroy it.
Yeah, we're going to release your album for Mother's Day. Oh, Dave, before I forget, going off that idea I had, for you to branch out, right?
Oh, yeah,
I thought
you
could be a tribute artist yourself, Dave.
Oh, right, okay.
You're a good singer. You're good at impressions.
Oh, very good.
Now,
thank you.
I was thinking who you could be. Now, what about Billy Joel?
Well,
have you still got a goatee, or?
Well, I'd have to put my shoes on my knees to be the same height as Billy Joel.
put a
curly wig.
No, he's
Curly
bald, wig. Isn't he?
He's bald now, of course.
Yeah.
You don't really need to look like them to be a tribute anyway, do you? But,
no.
But the thing is, that's very good. I can't play the piano like Billy Joel. My God, he's a brilliant player.
You can play
it. I can never do it like he does it. But, it's a very interesting one. You know, I have been thinking a little bit along these lines, though, Lee. Yes, but it's not... It's kind of going really retro, to be honest. Because I do a lot of Sinatra in what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of thinking, and I've been keeping this to myself, so I wasn't really going to advertise this on an international podcast, indeed. But I have an idea for a Sinatra-based show, to be honest. where it wouldn't be impressions so much as me interpreting the songs, but there would be all songs that Sinatra told, with monologues in between, talking about what a rather mercurial character Frank Sinatra was. So juxtaposing the idea of Sinatra, this fantastic artist who did these beautiful songs, against the fact that he could be a bit of a cunt, which I thought would be quite interesting to tell some anecdotes and stories about Sinatra and his life and mix it with these some of these brilliant recordings. I've got some great Sinatra backing tracks, you know. And I still think there's a big market for him.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, we're talking like, God, some of his music 70 or 80 years old now, isn't it? It's a long, it's a very old stuff, but it's still there. It's in people's psyche, isn't it?
Didn't Matt Goss do a Sinatra show?
This is the problem, isn't it? You know.
Following in his footsteps. No, in all seriousness, I could see that, Dave.
Well, I kind of thought I could make it into something a little bit more dramatic and a little bit more interesting than just a tribute act. And if I wasn't to do that, I mean, a Billy Joel thing, or to do something a little bit more modern.
If you're doing a tribute act, you've got to find a gap in the market, really, haven't you? Who doesn't have a tribute act? I mean, amazingly, there's like half a dozen people doing a bloody Gary Barlow tribute act. I mean, that's embarrassing, isn't it? Admitting that. Yeah.
What is good about doing so much performing for me, though, is it's made me think about that, which I think is a feasible thing that I could do quite quickly, and a little bit of research, write a few interesting monologues about Sinatra. So it wouldn't be a tribute. It wouldn't be an impression. I wouldn't do it as an impression. It would be an interpretation of his most famous songs, talking about who he was as a person, like a potted history of him. Aside from that, I wouldn't mind redoing my failed pop star show and link it to get bums on seats with a charity. Probably do them both. I could kind of interested in doing them both and linking it with a charity. But being honest, taking a fee, let the charity take the lion's share. There's a couple of very, very good charities around here, like hospice charities and stuff. And I'm actually going to be having chats.
You're virtually performing in hospices, aren't you, Dave?
Oh! Hey, do you know what? They're incredible, these people. I think they're going to live forever. I'm doing something right because I'm not seeing anybody. There's only been a couple that I know of that have popped up.
What are you going to say? There's not been anybody died.
No one's died while I've been singing. That's not happened yet, as for sure not. But it's nice to see that I go back to the same places and they're still there. You know, I've been doing this since I started in August last year doing this.
Yeah.
So I'm dead proud. You know what? I'm dead proud of myself, really, mate. Because
you should be. I wasn't taking the piss.
Oh, no, you weren't. And I'm not, honestly, I know you weren't. And no offence taken at all. I really not. And sometimes I'm thinking, God, you know, there are times I think, I can't believe he's come to this with those ambitions of, you know, pop stardom and everything. But what I realise is I'm doing like a really decent thing. You know, it is a really good thing. It makes people's days big time, you know. And,
And
I do it with gusto and I make it an entertainment. It's a pretty good show. I could put it on the road, you know, because it's kind of like, I think I told you this before, it's kind of like Bobby Ball meets a crooner. It's like Tommy and Bobby all in one, you know, because I throw a little kind of like cabaret jokes around, you know, get people laughing.
Dave, I seriously think you should do a tour poster.
I should tour it.
I could help you with this. If you get yourself, if you send me a few good pictures and the dates that you've got lined up.
Well, I tell you what, buddy, I'm a bit tired. I'm absolutely knackered because I've done, I did two gigs yesterday and two today. So back to back, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Mm. So, you know, it's still not like working, but it's pretty tired when you think about it. You know, I go in and I do a show for like an hour and 20 minutes, constant singing, bit of keyboard, bit of this, bit of that, sweating cobs. Last month, I did 8 in 4 days, which was my most that I've done. That's pretty mega. And also, like today, I travelled from Clangochlin in the morning, there at 11 o'clock in the morning, to Rhyl in the afternoon. Well, if Clangochlin to Rhyl, it's in the same county, but it's literally one end of the county to the other. you know. So it's good stuff, though.
You know,
I'm lucky because something that I did as a hobby with ambitions to be a career when I was younger has come back. And it's like, in a way, it's like, Lee, if you wanted to stop doing what you were doing and become a carpenter, because you're a brilliant, you are a brilliant carpenter, you could do that. You're lucky because you've got another string to your bow. I realised, oh my God, I'm lucky. I can do this. You know, not many people can stand in front of other people and perform songs and stuff. Because of the experience I've had in the past, I can do it. Happy days. And make someone who's 100 years old smile. Or make someone who's got dementia, make someone who's got dementia start singing every fucking word of a song.
I could see, it's I could see this being a nice docu-soap, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, following you round, a bit like Jane McDonald on the cruises. Dave on his US tour of the care homes.
This is why I'm thinking the Sinatra thing. I want to get a spot on a cruise. Supplement it with a few weeks away on a cruise.
Sure. You know what, Dave? I reckon you could do that dead easy. You just phone up these venues like the Bury Met. I mean, they're always putting on tribute acts. Tribute acts are massive now. People go and see them. You know, if you look at the local theatre here, the Bury Met, if you just have a look on the website, tons of tribute. I mean, that's where I saw AC/DC and I saw the Smiths. It's a nice little venue. And
I reckon you'd get a lot of people if you did something like a Kenny Rogers tribute or something like that.
Yeah, I think there is a Kenny Rogers one.
I reckon like that kind of like country or Glen. I mean, I'd quite happily do Glen Campbell. I love a lot of Glen Campbell songs.
Yeah, so do
you
I.
You know, like Wichita Lineman. It's one of the best songs ever written. He's done some great stuff, Glen Campbell. Yeah. In fact, Glen Campbell would be brilliant to do.
I think Guns N' Roses covered Wichita Lineman. It's one of Axl Rose's favourite songs.
When I got my double page, twice actually, I got a double page centre spread column interview in the Manchester Evening News. Quite proud of that. But my first one, which was interviewed by, I think his name was Lee Henshaw, lovely fellow. We had a really long conversation and he really liked my music and everything. And he paid me the most fantastic compliment. He said, Dave Lawton is a modern day songwriter with the skills of Jimmy Webb. I mean, I was floored.
Who's Jimmy Webb? Sorry.
Jimmy Webb wrote Galveston, Wichita Lineman, McCarthy Park.
Wow.
Right? He wrote all these like massive 60s hits, you know?
Yeah.
Like McCarthy Park. You know, someone left the cake out in the rain. But Wichita Lineman stands for me as one of the best songs ever written. I just think it's amazing. It evokes these like these thoughts of this guy doing his, you know, working on the telephone wires up high and dreaming about his girl and thinking about his job. It's so clever. It's so simple, but this is where to me, like Noel Gallagher, he's not there. He's not quite got it. Because he's a great tune writer, but he hasn't got that ability to imagine a story. But Jimmy Webb is like Ray Davis, and he can imagine. And Damon Albarn can. He can create a narrative, a story within the song. I love that.
Yeah.
I fucking love that.
Not to be ordinary. I warn you not to be young. I warn you not to fall ill. And I warn you not to grow old.
To license it. It's